RV podcast listeners, a quick notice before we get started on today's podcast. On October the 4th, Emperors of Rome will be celebrating episode CC. That's right, our 200th episode will be on Cleopatra and Antony. Rhiannon Evans and I will be appearing at Acme Studios in Melbourne at 6 p.m. to record our live show, and that's October 4th. Tickets are free. You can find links on the Emperors of Rome Facebook page and on our Twitter account at Rome Podcast. Hope to see you there. Second notice, this episode of Emperors of Rome comes with a content warning. There are adult insults written on missiles. There is also some very rude Augustan poetry. Please be advised, sensibilities and small ears will be harmed. And on that note, here's the podcast. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXCVII, The Perusine War. With Antony distracted with developments in the East, Fulvia finds herself in the familiar position of advocating for her husband's interests. This escalated to a war with Octavian, the outcome of which would leave Fulvia isolated. Here's Rhiannon Evans. So in the aftermath of the civil war, the triumvirate really doesn't play very nicely together. So the best thing for them to do, they decide, is to divvy up the Roman Empire administratively. So Antony goes to the east, Lepidus gets Africa. Broadly speaking, Octavian gets the rest. So he gets Rome, which he thinks is great, but he also kind of realizes how important what Antony has to how the empire is functioning, because Egypt in particular is kind of seen as the breadbasket of Rome at that time, with all the crops that are being brought in and those kind of things. Lots of resources, I think, are up for grabs there.
Egypt's not technically part of the empire, but yeah, the East in general is wealthy.
Yeah.
So you get the feeling in the sources that both of them think they've outdone the other, that the West isn't that great, and so it's fine to give it to Octavian. But he will play on that for the rest of his life, the fact that he's popular in Italy, that Italy backed him.
And he's also got the prestige and the administrative hub of the Roman Empire with him in Italy there. So with Antony going east, Fulvia stays behind in Rome, doesn't she? So she's there very much in the role that she's played for her previous husbands, as in, I am advocating for my husband's interests in Rome. I'm his proxy, maybe to some extent.
Yeah, that's largely how this part of her life is read now. So previously there've been, and following the ancient sources and their biases, as we'll see, this idea that she kind of strides out on her own and she is this strident kind of woman, this anomaly. But if you look at every event in sequence, you can see that what she's doing is supporting Antony, that she's absolutely being his voice in Rome.
What happens initially then? How does Octavian use this to his advantage? And how does it, as a result, undermine Antony and Fulvia?
The most immediate duty they have to perform is to give land to the veterans, which is going to involve tearing land away from a lot of people. This is part of the proscription process. And it's going to be deeply unpopular with the people who lose their land. Thousands and thousands of people will be worse done by this. But of course, it's been promised to the veterans. This is why they have fought for Octavian. This is how they won at Philippi. What it results in is that there's tension over who claims credit for doing it, for carrying it out, a difficult task, an admittedly difficult task. Fulvia doesn't like the fact that Octavian takes all the credit, and she wants to reserve some of that for Antony. He made that promise too, after all, and they were his troops as well. So in a way, Fulvia is the proxy for Antony in terms of the tensions between the two.
How does this manifest itself? He, in some way, starts taking out his frustration, his anger on Fulvia. Is that a good way to characterize it?
Apparently so. Fulvia, here we can see her acting in a way that you might not expect of women, that she, according to Appian, had gone with her children, indeed, to the new settlements where the veterans are being installed to remind the veterans that they owe Antony. Dio, our other main source, tells us, remembering that Octavian is married to Fulvia's daughter at this point.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Caesar could not endure the difficult temper of his mother-in-law, says Dio at Book 48, Chapter 5. And choosing to appear to be at odds with her rather than with Antony, he sent back her daughter with the remark that she was still a virgin, a statement which he confirmed by an oath, indifferent whether it should be thought that the woman had remained a virgin in his house so long a time for other reasons, or whether it should seem that he had planned it long in advance by way of preparing for the future. So Dio's giving him various possible motivations there, that he always wanted to have a way out, or that he was never that keen on her anyway. And in a way, he says it doesn't matter because it does give him a way out of this connection with Fulvia and by extension, Antony. Dio tells us something very important, that Octavian can shift the blame onto Fulvia. And we'll see quite a lot of this, that it's like fighting a war somewhere else rather than with your real enemy. You know, during the Cold War, we had all of those proxy wars between the US and the USSR.
Yeah.
This is a bit like the position Fulvia. She's like Vietnam. But it allows him to be at war with Antony without openly being at war with Antony, or be antagonistic.
Yeah, yeah. If you move directly against Fulvia, you're still damaging Antony, but you've got plausible deniability almost to some extent.
I think it shows us partly how clever Octavian is, I have to say it, and how Fulvia is, she's doing what she can to bolster Antony. You know, she's acting in a really strong way, but she's still open to manipulation just because women can't openly have power.
Mm. The other part of it, I guess, as well, is that Antony makes himself quite comfortable over in Egypt. And so this signals to Octavian that he doesn't entirely need to keep Antony on side anymore.
Yeah, I think the sources have been read in a very particular way here. I think that's what will happen. But the timeline is not entirely clear. And our sources, say Appian, attribute to Fulvia motives based around what Antony ultimately does, which is stay with Cleopatra, that Fulvia's actions are because she's jealous of Cleopatra. All right, Appian actually says in Book 5, Chapter 3, Fulvia, moved by a woman's jealousy, incited Lucius, that's Antony's brother, to discord. All right, so she kind of picks a fight because she's annoyed that Antony's picked another woman. In fact, Antony has already had a well-publicized affair while out east, which doesn't seem to have bothered her. I guess Cleopatra's a queen. But as I say, the timelines are a bit loose here because Appian is basically attributing her jealousy to a motivation for an upcoming war, which is quite a way of dealing with marital jealousy. And he's also talking about the ambitions of the commanders, i.e. Lucius, but it's mostly Fulvia who's blamed. Now, I think it's quite right that most scholars see this as very suspect, definitely misogyny going on here, and most of them would date the Cleopatra-Antony relationship actually after the war, the Perusine War that we're going to be talking about. There's an article by Catherine Welsh where she makes this case very strongly. So it probably isn't the reason. There are other things going on, and largely Fulvia's motivation seems to be entirely to keep Antony's name and power alive in Italy.
Yeah.
And Octavian is the one who's trying to whittle that away.
Yeah, okay. All right, so you've got the land being settled for the veterans, which there would be a preference that Antony gets some glory for that as well, but it's happening in his absence. And the supposed jealousy as being the motivation for inciting this sort of conflict. Are we giving too much agency to Fulvia for this sort of stuff, too much Augustan propaganda blaming it on her? Or is it also partially attributed to the other people that Antony left behind, i.e. generals, military men, and his brother Lucius?
Yeah, I think that to an extent Lucius is downplayed. I mean, he's a general, that's a lot of power, in order to shift a lot of the blame onto Fulvia. So it's kind of playing the game that Octavian would play afterwards, and to a certain extent Antony too. So, spoilers, Octavian and Antony are going to make a pact at the end of this. Quite useful for Antony to be able to say that Fulvia was to blame.
Yeah.
But our sources are very confused here, because Appian also says that Fulvia told Lucius, Antony's brother, that it was the wrong time for a war. All right, this is the quote at Book 5 of the Civil Wars, Chapter 10. Fulvia blamed Lucius, him, for stirring up war at an inopportune time. So if she actually said that, then it makes no sense that she's the one blamed for stirring up the war. But Appian also says that, so he seems to have his motivations a bit all over the place.
Yeah.
He does then, he tries to square it by saying that another general, Manius, maliciously changed her mind by going on about Cleopatra. But back to that idea of jealousy motivating it. But you can see that Appian has sources that don't make sense with his idea that it's all Fulvia's fault. So he has to kind of make a way around it by saying somebody else told her about Cleopatra.
Yeah.
Dio and Appian are our main sources and our main detailed sources for this period. But even much closer to the time, we have a source like Velleius Paterculus, who's writing in the late Augustan, early Tiberian period, who's doing much the same kind of thing. So, you know, you can see that what the later writers are doing is based on what we've got happening at this time. Velleius Paterculus wrote a very short two-book history of Rome and Rome's conflicts. And in book 2, chapter 74, he says, Lucius Antonius, the consul, who shared the faults of his brother, that's Mark Antony, but possessed none of the virtues, so dig at Lucius there,
wow,
which he occasionally showed, even Antony only occasionally shows them, by making charges against Caesar before the veterans at one moment, and at the next inciting to arms those who had lost their farms when the division of lands was ordered and colonists assigned, had collected a large army. So he's giving a lot of aid agency to Lucius here, and he's saying he's just seeing what grievances are out there and picking on them, very much like politicians still do, actually.
Yeah.
And then he moves into major misogyny. In another quarter, Fulvia, the wife of Antony, who had nothing of the woman in her except her sex, was creating general confusion by armed violence. It is a very general accusation, but largely she's not womanly enough.
She could take that as a compliment, depending what she's aiming for, really.
It gives us a bit further this idea that she's almost there on the battlefield,
yeah,
which we've got no evidence for, and even our very hostile sources don't go that far.
Yeah. I get the impression from these proceedings that she's very far back from the action, but still attributed with it happening.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Anyway, let's get on with the action, shall we? I'm always going to pronounce this wrong. What's the Perusine War?
No, that's good.
Okay. Why is it called that?
Because it takes place at Perusia, which is modern Perugia with a G. And it's largely a siege. War is, I think, a little bit of a misnomer.
Okay. Yeah. But still Roman against Roman.
Yes, exactly.
It's so soon after war. Romans against last Romans. Yeah.
Well, it's a century of civil war, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can see why they were quite happy for it all to end when it does.
One thing that we've got happening is Lucius's army briefly occupies Rome and he makes a speech.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big deal, bringing an army to Rome. And Fulvia is credited with this, and I think probably was involved. Between them, they've raised 8 legions. That's a lot to fight on behalf of Antony. And Lucius makes a speech when he occupies Rome, which is, again, backing Antony, promising that he's going to dissolve the triumvirate. So it hasn't been around that long, but it's going. It's, I guess it's accomplished its goal of avenging Julius Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
So do we need it anymore? And he's going to become consul instead, because apparently you can just declare yourself consul now.
Yeah, but you can pretty much, yeah.
Whoever's got the army. And the quote from Appian is that he should visit punishment upon Octavius and Lepidus for their lawless rule, and that his brother would voluntarily resign his share of it and accept the consulship, exchanging an unlawful magistracy for a lawful one and establishing the government of their fathers in place of a tyranny. So he's playing up very much the idea that it's Antony who's going to bring back the Republic.
I was about to say, this is restoring the Republic kind of
which
rhetoric.
Which is what Octavian will definitely do. And I don't know whether it's deliberate. I haven't gone and looked at the original text, but calling him Octavius is denying him the adoption. It's not even not calling him Caesar. It's not calling him Octavian, which is the name he gets when he's adopted by Caesar.
Where's Fulvia during this time?
Well, not that close. So Perugia or Perusia in antiquity is north in Umbria, north of Rome. And Fulvia's gone the other direction. She's gone to Praeneste, 20, 30 kilometers south of Rome.
Yeah.
Nice day trip. She's gone apparently to be with Lepidus. Now, her movements aren't fully clear. You know, our sources are never very clear on what Fulvia's up to. They're just kind of using her when they want to, rather than tracing what she's up to. But that's according to Appian. She's gone off to spend time with Lepidus. And Dio has her, much more dramatically, in charge of and addressing the troops. He says, Fulvia occupied Praeneste. So wherever she goes, she's occupying, apparently, and deliberated with senators and knights, even sending orders where required. And why should anyone be surprised at this? Here comes the moralizing. When she would gird herself with a sword, give out the watchword to the soldiers, and in many instances harangue them, all of which gave additional offense to Caesar. That's Dio, book 48, chapter 10.
See, once again, you know, take this as a compliment, girl.
The giving out the watchword is a big deal. I mean, haranguing, talking to the troops like you're the general. That's the general's job. And giving the watchword is as well.
Wearing a sword, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All of that. It's all manly behaviour. That's basically how she's being characterised here, as usurping the position of a general.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Lucius retreats to Perusia, so he's going to the north.
Yeah, and it's a fortified city. I should have mentioned that. That's why it's important here, and that's why a siege is really the only way out of this, because the enemy can't get in. Fulvia, in the meantime, is getting more troops together, according to Appian, book 533, and she's encouraging people. Appian says, Fulvia urged Ventidius, Asinius, Ateus, and Calenus to hasten from Gaul to the assistance of Lucius. So she's kind of corralling the troops. Get the legions down there from Gaul. We need you here. We need you in northern Italy. And they do come, but they're not much use. They defeat a legion of Octavian's troops along the way. So I guess that's a bit of use. But they seem to just watch the siege from a distance. They don't directly intervene. And Dio claims that she may have sought help from the governor of Africa. It's not entirely clear whether that's directly referring to Perusia. But the evidence seems to suggest that she is trying to gather more troops to help with this operation. Yeah. So while she's probably almost certainly not on the battlefield, she is trying to get the cavalry to arrive, as it were, to save the day, trying to be more use than Antony can be out east.
So Octavian's army lays siege to Perusia for a good couple of months until this is resolved. And that is honestly the extent of the war.
Yeah, and it's all through the winter. I mean, it would have been terrible, horrible deprivation. So hopefully Fulvia wasn't there.
We do have a good record of a lot of the sling bullets that have been found in the area.
Yeah.
Do you want to take us through the various dirty words?
Yeah. It's made of lead.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, that's going to hurt if it hits you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I guess the way we have them now, they're sort of oval shaped, like a flattened pebble. Gosh, I've never actually seen one. I've only seen pictures of them.
Yeah.
I think about 4 or 5 centimeters across.
Yeah, you can pretty much, you know, hold them weightily in your hand. You put that in a leather sling, swing it around a bit, let it go. If your aim is true, off it goes over the battlements and pegs someone in the head.
Indeed. Yeah. All right. So it's a missile.
Yeah.
The kind of simplest sort, except not made of stone, made of lead and therefore cast. And that's all you need. But the Romans, being the Romans, wrote insulting messages on them.
Just as a bit of an insult, but also as a curse if you really wanted to, I guess.
Yeah.
But there were lots of insults. So they've found a lot of these around the side of Perusia by the sounds of it.
They have, yes. We do have them. And
I'm going to make you read these out.
Yeah, that's fine. Lead's very soft and they could have been incised, but they're not incised. They're cast with the messages on them because they're in relief. So this is very deliberate. This is not just your ordinary squaddy wanting to write something insulting on it.
Just chiseling away on it.
This is somebody in charge putting these messages on. So this is organized insults.
Nice.
Just before we get there. And a lot of these insults, they go both ways, are directed at Lucius and Fulvia, but also at Octavian.
Oh, so these have been thrown back in the other direction.
Yeah, it's both directions they're coming in.
Yeah.
One of my favorites, it's brief and to the point. Octavi fellas, which means Octavius, you suck, literally. You're a sucker. It's very obscene. I mean, we use suck in a way that isn't particularly, but Phalas is not gentle. On the other side, Lucius Antonius, baldy, was an insult then. You're dead. Victory belongs to Gaius Caesar.
Oh, that's quite a big missile for that one.
Yeah, it would have to be a very small cast of writing. Giving him is the name he likes, by the way. I'm looking for Octavian's ass. Arse, as we would say in Britain. That's kind of strange because it's putting...
Oh, no, this next one's terrible.
It is terrible.
Whoa.
All right, well, I'll read that one out because rather than comment on it. I'm looking for Fulvia's clitoris.
Whoa.
That's
good aim.
I don't know what to say. One that's now lost, Lucius Antonius, baldy. And Fulvia, spread your cheeks.
What?
Very good aim with all of these. The two in the middle, which I'm not going to repeat, are interesting. I know that they're really obscene, but they're interesting they're in the first person, as if the bullet itself is talking.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they're already very direct and intimate, but a certain increase in the intimacy when it's I'm looking for, I'm seeking, I'm aiming at.
Let my aim be true. Mm. I'm going to have to put a disclaimer.
Absolutely.
A bullet sling disclaimer at the start of this episode, I think, because that's just...
Yeah, yeah.
Whoa.
If you want the full detail on that, It's only partially preserved, and there is discussion about whether it's not a very common word, as you might in our extant literature. But there's a lot of discussion about whether it actually does say that. But there's, I don't think there's much else it could
if
be.
If it does say what? Which
if,
one?
If it does say the word that means clitoris.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm impressed that the Romans found it.
When, by the way, when I looked that word up in my dictionary,
yeah,
it translates it into Greek. It doesn't give you the English. It's an old dictionary. A modern dictionary wouldn't do that.
Don't ask us, ask the Greeks.
That's how obscene it was considered.
Okay. While we've got the disclaimer emblazoned on this episode, I think you should, you again are going to read out this Martial epigram. So this, for context, is a rude poem that Martial recorded Octavian writing about Fulvia.
Indeed. So, you know, Martial, oh, and it's in book 11. That's the obscene book of Martial.
Wow.
So very suitable that it should be there. And I believe from memory that the reason he quotes this is to defend himself, to say, look, even Octavian
it's not just me doing this sort of stuff. Yeah.
It's Augustus, our first emperor from 100 years ago.
Mm.
So the book here has allegedly written by Octavian, but certainly this is what Martial says. So he starts off with, this is not Octavian, he kind of sets it up. Spiteful censor of the Latin language, read six insolent verses of Caesar Augustus.
Yeah, so if you think I'm bad and you're censoring me, here's what Augustus wrote.
Yeah, then the quote marks. Because Antony fucks Glaphyra, Fulvia has arranged this punishment for me, that I fuck her too. That I fuck Fulvia? What, if Manius begged me to bugger him, would I? I don't think so, if I was sane. Either fuck or let's fight, she says. Doesn't she know my prick is dearer to me than life itself? Let the trumpets blare. Augustus, this is outside of the quote, you certainly grant my clever little book's pardon, since you are the expert at speaking with Roman frankness.
Ah, okay, so that's nice. You know, I should be able to get away with it because you've set precedent.
Yeah, so that poem is saying, if Fulvia wants to fuck or fight, I'd rather fight. Basically, he's turning her down
in
the most insulting way.
And that he very much values his penis.
So Glaphyra is the woman that Antony had kind of openly had the affair with before Cleopatra, which kind of makes a nonsense of Fulvia being jealous.
Yes.
Seeing as she would have known all about this.
Okay. All right. That is all siege and war aside. Terrible way to speak of a Roman woman.
Yeah, it is, of an elite Roman woman.
Yeah.
And I have to say, in book 11 of Martial and in his other obscene poems, it's usually about sex workers or kind of anonymous women, old women. He's really ageist. So the fact that it's aimed at somebody specific, a real figure who is an aristocrat, is very striking.
But it's almost like, you know, Fulvia, I am facing you on the battlefield. The slings show this as well. We've got an extra way to fight you, as in we're going to not just attack you on the battlefield, we're going to attack your gender as well.
Yeah, and attack your genitals. I mean, it's rape that's being threatened here to both men and women.
Yeah. Okay, that's all very... It's not a kind of, you know, gentlemanly, noble kind of war. You're not fighting with principles here when you're doing things like that. So the siege ends after 2 months. There is a siege, of course. Sorry, we should get back to the siege. It ends in February 40 BCE. And a resounding success for Octavian.
Absolutely. So there's a certain amount of Octavian trying to lay down his reputation for mercy here. So Dio tells us the leader, i.e. Lucius, and some others obtained pardon. But most of the senators and knights, that's the equestrians, were put to death.
Mm.
So it's pretty limited mercy. And the story goes that they did not merely suffer death in an ordinary form, but were led to the altar consecrated to the former Caesar, i.e. Julius Caesar, and there were sacrificed.
Sacrificed?
Sacrificed.
That's a loaded word. You're sacrificing Romans. That's not just fighting against them now.
Even a human sacrifice
is
real taboo and for special, very special circumstances. So 300 knights and many set.
Not only that, altar consecrated to the former Caesar.
Yeah, because it's revenge. You could say that everything Octavian does from this point on for quite a while is couched as vengeance.
Mm.
So, you know, when he eventually builds a temple of Mars the Avenger, we often think that that is vengeance for Caesar's death, although it's not entirely clear. I did read something recently that really questioned whether this was a sacrifice.
I've got to wonder, you know.
They think it was rhetorical, you know.
Does Dio have this right, you know?
Well, Suetonius says it as well. It's clearly going around.
Okay.
I guess either way, it seems like he killed a lot of people here mm-hmm. who had presumably surrendered. Dio names some of them, and then he tells us it's kind of equally bad for the people of Perusia, who really had nothing to do with this. Their city was just invaded and dragged into it. The people there and others who were captured there from outside the city, the majority of them lost their lives.
Mm.
And the city itself, except the temple of Vulcan and the statue of Juno, was entirely destroyed by fire. So yes. That's the vengeance it gets. It just gets razed to the ground, apart from these two monuments.
So it said at the start of this quote then that the leaders and some others obtained pardons. So that was Fulvia and Lucius Antonius, mm-hmm. who were both kind of spared. But as a result, Antony, I imagine, wouldn't be that impressed with them. He would have been very impressed and in favour if they had won. But now they've not only embarrassed him, but they've lost. They've lost in his name.
Yeah, this is where, again, Fulvia's presence, however distant it was, gives Antony plausible deniability, basically allows him to distance himself from this. But there's clearly some manoeuvring going on because, as we said, Lucius is spared and, in fact, he's given a governorship of a province, but off to the west, far from the base of action in Spain.
Mm.
So he's protected by Antony, but he's also not kept around to be part of whatever deal will now be made.
Yeah, yeah. And quite a lot of prominent people leave Rome. Some of them go to Mark Antony. Some of them go to Sextus Pompey. Mm. There is a quite good note here.
Yep. So Dio tells us, book 48, chapter 15, I quote, Tiberius Claudius Nero had been in charge of a garrison in Campania, that's southern Italy. And when Caesar's party got the upper hand, he withdrew with his wife Livia Drusilla and with his son Tiberius Claudius Nero.
So that's Livia, future wife of Octavian, once she gets back on the right side of things.
And the son, Tiberius Claudius Nero, is the future emperor Tiberius.
Mm. So Fulvia herself goes east to meet Antony in Greece and doesn't really get a warm reception.
She doesn't, but on the way there, before she gets there, I think it's worth noting that she gets a really big escort. She's not just skulking off in the night.
Mm.
So she has to go to Brundisium in southern Italy to get the boat over to Greece. And she and her sons are accompanied by 3,000 cavalry provided by Antony's generals. This is from Appian in book 5, chapter 50. So they don't feel that she is not worth protecting or that she's failed.
Maybe they're trying to make sure she doesn't start something.
What, 3,000 cavalry to do that? It also seems like too many to me. I'm not entirely sure I believe it, but I think it is meant to indicate that she's kind of a big enough name and important enough to need this huge escort.
Mm.
But as you say, when she arrives, we're told that Antony is very disappointed with her. You know, you have to be cynical about this and think that it probably is Antony keeping his options open for an easier reconciliation with Octavian. Mm. We've already mentioned the ability to shift the blame here. For Fulvia, it all trails off a bit because she dies this year in 40. Mm. She goes to Sicyon, where she dies of an unknown illness.
Ambiguous and convenient.
Oh, you think conspiracy here. None of our sources mention a conspiracy. Be clear, listeners.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is just complete mad. Okay. As you say.
If you're going to do your I, Claudius prequel.
Oh, there's pigs all over this. Quicker than boiled asparagus, mm-hmm. Fulvia is conveniently dead.
Well, you know, there were all kinds of ailments going around at the time.
It is convenient timing
for
all involved. Because
absolutely.
Antony can say it was all Fulvia. Octavian can say it was all Fulvia.
And by the way, they can also blame the proscriptions on her.
Yeah.
Taking that land away, very unpopular.
Mm.
Well, let's put it down to that evil woman who's now conveniently gone.
And that's essentially what's been done with her.
Yeah. So our sources, which have been damning all the way along, at her death kind of sum up what a terrible person she was. So Appian, book 559, he says, the news came that Fulvia was dead. It was said she was dispirited by Antony's reproaches and fell sick. So she kind of had a broken heart because Antony had rebuffed her.
Mm.
And it was thought she'd become a willing victim of disease on account of the anger of Antony, who had left her while she was sick and had not even visited her when he was going away.
Yeah.
Okay. Which I guess, even in a hostile source, I mean, I don't put much store by this, but is relaying that Fulvia was dedicated to Antony.
And Antony doesn't come out well in that. Yeah.
The death of this turbulent woman, that's a great phrase, who had stirred up so disastrous a war on account of her jealousy of Cleopatra, we've dealt with that, seemed extremely fortunate to both of the parties who were rid of her. Mm. Nevertheless, Appian loves to contradict himself. Antony was very much saddened by this event because he considered himself, in some sense, the cause of it. Even Antony has a bit of conscience in Appian.
In some sense, he says.
Just a bit guilty.
Showing the viability still of an alliance between Antony and Octavian, Antony marries Octavian's sister, Octavia.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is kind of what we were, I think, referring to as... it'd been very opportune. He could have divorced Fulvia. It wasn't that difficult, but he doesn't even have to do that. He is now available. And Antony's never not married for long.
And I suppose it makes up for very convenient for Octavian because he just divorced Fulvia's daughter.
Yeah. So all of that is broken away, but you can maintain the alliance with Antony, at least for a bit.
Yeah. So while there's a lot of hostility towards her and our sources are largely negative and there is a big scapegoat element to how we remember Fulvia, was there any good outcome of remembering her?
We do have ground level evidence that people in the East thought highly of her. So this is Antony's stronghold. And indeed, in ancient Phrygia, there was a city called Eumenea, which renamed itself Fulvia. So it changed its name to Fulvia to commemorate her. So this is obviously something they think to please Antony, but her name has such resonance and literally has resonance after that. And there's a coin that kind of celebrates this, that on the obverse, on the face of it, has a profile of a woman and she's got little wings, so she looks like a winged victory.
Mm.
But it's often thought that that might be a profile of Fulvia herself.
Yeah.
And if that were the case, then she's the first Roman woman to appear on any coin.
Mm.
It is debated, but that would be incredible if she's that important to turn up on a coin. I'd like to think so.
Okay. So in summing, I'm not sure what to make of Fulvia. I can't entirely trust our sources. I'd like to think more of her in a yay feminism, look at what she achieved kind of thing for the time she lived. But I don't know if I should be doing that, if that's me looking at it with modern sensibilities. So where do you land on the Fulvia spectrum?
It's hard. And look, it's hard for many women because of the way our sources treat them. And I think Fulvia is kind of at the outer extreme of how difficult it is because she is demonized. She's not the only one, but she's given all of the blame for everything that goes badly in this period. And, you know, she certainly allows our sources, which follow the Augustan line largely, to let Octavian off the hook a lot. And I guess even maybe give him a reason for siding with Antony, which there might have been some questions about later on when they end up at war with each other.
Yeah.
Why make the alliance at all when it looked like they were openly hostile? Well, actually, he was only hostile to Fulvia. And why wouldn't you be? There's a woman who's out of her place. I do think, unfortunately, sometimes Fulvia has been seen as this feminist icon, and that's pretty much always anachronistic. I don't think there's anything wrong with kind of looking back and vibrancy or agency with these women, but you can take it completely out of context if you see Fulvia as somebody who's arriving on the battlefield in full armor.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Yeah. But the other side of it is that when you look at Roman history, there are slim pickings for feminist icons.
Yeah, that's true. And look, I guess it depends what you want from your feminism to a certain point of view. I think that most of the evidence gives us a Fulvia who's entirely backing her man. It may or may not be how you want to see heroic women from the past. It certainly could have been made a suitable role model for a woman by the Romans. So in their own terms, if we want to talk about the Romans' own terms, it's exactly the kind of PR that Octavia gets. So Octavia will later on rally troops for Antony, and she will get out there and do exactly the same thing as Fulvia did. But she will be praised for it because she's on the side of the winners. She's part of the Julian family.
Mm.
Whereas Fulvia, and she's in this very difficult period of history where there is all of this maneuvering going on. So she allows both of the factions to kind of gloss over the difficult relationship they're having, and even more conveniently dies But even if she hadn't died, I think she would have been entirely demonized for what happened in this period.
Yeah.
She gets treated very symbolically. But I think that we could look at her through the eyes that Octavia's seen through later on and see her as somebody who doesn't just stand in the background. She's out there. She's advocating for Antony always. And if Antony had won and she had lived, she'd have been the first empress, presumably.
That was Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.